Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
In the late hours of July 22, 1991, Milwaukee, Wisconsin changed forever. Detective Patrick "Pat" Kennedy would meet a man who had altered many lives in devastating ways. Nothing could possibly have prepared Kennedy for what he witnessed that fateful night as he rolled out to the call of a potential murder scene. The Milwaukee Cannibal, the Monster of Milwaukee as Jeffrey Dahmer would come to be known, was the serial killer who drugged, photographed, strangled, sexually assaulted, dismembered, and in some cases, cannibalized 17 young men during a three-year period in a small one-bedroom efficiency apartment. Dahmer Detective, the interrogation investigation that shocked the world, goes inside the police interrogation room where Kennedy spent long days during six chaotic weeks with Dahmer as he confessed to his life as a serial killer. While the world's media clamored outside for information and confirmation, the story of one of the most notorious criminals of the 20th century. The book that we're featuring this evening is Dahmer Detective, The Investigation and Interrogation That Shocked the World, with my special guest journalist and author, Robin Maharaj. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Robin Maharaj.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you very much, Robin. This is for our audience. This is an exclusive. This is the very first time that Robin has been officially interviewed about this debut book that she's co-authored, and an incredible for everybody that's interested in Dahmer or thinks they know anything about Jeffrey Dahmer. This is the definitive book that you need to know and find out about. So let's jump right in there immediately. How did it come to be that you met Pat Kennedy, found out about this manuscript? How did it come to be that you were in the right place, sort of a fateful event, that you would come into contact with Pat Kennedy? Tell us a little bit about that.
I had read an article or a sort of a top 10 list, I guess, if you will, about sort of the world's most evil people. And Jeffrey Dahmer actually top three on this list. And it sort of puzzled me a little bit, and it made me really want to reacquaint myself with the case and do a little bit more exploration. So I went to YouTube and I looked at a couple of videos, and of course Patrick Kennedy was featured in most of them. After the Dahmer case, he was sort of Milwaukee PD's go-to guy on the Dahmer case. And so I got in touch with him actually through a film he was in that was out in 2012. It was called The Jeffrey Dahmer Files. And he was featured in that. He was one of sort of three people that was interviewed about the Dahmer case. It was him, it was a neighbor, and then it was the medical examiner in Milwaukee. So I sent sort of a fan letter, if you will, but mostly one just in terms of how I thought that, you know, it was him specifically who actually got Dahmer to talk. And that, you know, I really thought he had done a marvelous job on the case and a good job in the interview for this film. And I just thought, you know, that would be the end of it. But he actually got in touch with me. He emailed me back, and that began a dialogue that we had for a couple of months. And in the course of that dialogue through email, I asked if I could interview him for a magazine article that I was even more interested in writing about Dahmer the more I learned about him from Kennedy. And he said, well, in the course of this messaging back and forth, that he actually had a manuscript. And he said, you know, because I was a writer and had done a lot of work with writers and editors, that, you know, he would love for me to read it and just sort of give him some feedback. And this had been a manuscript that he had kind of written immediately after the Dahmer case, just to kind of get it all off his chest and out of his mind, I guess. And right. Then he kind of would work on it for a little bit and then go put it in the drawer for a bit and then kind of come back. and he had brought it out again to be featured for this film and just to kind of reacquaint himself with some of the facts of the story. And so, but at this point, he was really interested in having me read it. So we actually agreed to meet in April of 2013, and I went down to Madison, Wisconsin for their film festival, where the Jeffrey Dahmer Files was being featured. And we had a wonderful interview and time together and wonderful conversation about Dahmer and about a lot of other things as well. I just found Patrick to be fascinating in terms of his work before he became a detective during his time in homicide. Of course, the Dahmer case and his relationship with Jeff Dahmer, and then everything he did afterwards, because for then on, he was known as the Dahmer detective and got interviewed a lot about it, had to talk about it a lot. And so he was sort of forever known in association with this very famous case. So I went down and we had this interview, and I agreed to look at his manuscript, and he agreed to be a subject in my interview for this magazine article. And he gave it to me, and I came home and I was starting to read it. And 5 days after the first time that we met, I learned that he had a heart attack. He had a fatal heart attack and died. So I went on after about 3 or 4 months to write this article. And then I didn't really do anything with it for a while because I wasn't really sure if I should or I could, because it really shocked me, even though I didn't know Kennedy that well and I only met him for the first time in Madison. I just, you know, I really connected. I really bonded with him, I think, over the course of our conversations. And so I went ahead and did the article, had it published in crimemagazine.com, and then began to be in touch with his widow, Patty, and she and I decided that, you know, it'd be a wonderful tribute to Patrick and a wonderful legacy for him just to have this book come out. So I began working on it as an editor, and then I had my own part to put in there as well.
Yes, and like I said, I want to reiterate that this is the definitive book because of the access. You rarely get this kind of access, and this is the ultimate access, is the detective that interviewed Jeffrey Dahmer. Not one of them, but the man that did this, and this is a brilliant interrogation. But I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. Let's get to before Pat Kennedy meets Jeffrey Dahmer, and as you vividly portray in the book, let's take us back to a story that people think they know or they've heard, or they heard different renditions of, but the Laotian boy that runs out into the middle of the street in despair. Tell us, as you describe again vividly in the book, about that scene in your book.
Okay. It was May of 1991. And it was sort of evening and getting into nighttime, and people on the street, it was a sort of a warm night, and so there was people out in the street congregating in front of their apartments and just out and about, kids coming around, teenagers probably more likely, and this boy stumbles out of an apartment, and he's not wearing anything. He's naked, and he probably within just seconds of sort of seeing him, I think most realized he was probably in some kind of distress. A woman grabbed something off of the back of her chair. I think it was like a windbreaker or something, and she ran over with it. And she was trying to speak with him and trying to kind of get from him, you know, what has happened? Why are you out here and what's going on? And he was slurring. He was slurring his words, and he wasn't really able to communicate with her. So she sort of looked over and found that another neighbor had called the police, and they were on their way and certainly probably could have. But some people were sort of just standing around, and there was definitely witnesses, you know, to what was going on. Most people not really wanting to probably get involved, wanting to see what was going to unfold, but not necessarily get involved. But this woman did get involved, and so she was trying to help him. And so she was sort of sheltering him a little bit, and again, just sort of trying to kind of keep him still until the police could get there. But he was probably obviously trying to get away a little bit. But police show up, and they kind of come up to the scene, and she starts telling them, you know, this boy's in trouble. I think he's been assaulted. Seems to have some, like, blood on him and, you know, some scratches and things. And he looks like he's a bit disheveled here. And they tried to get from the boy, you know, sort of who are you, what's going on. And he isn't really able to communicate with them either. Again, he's slurring. He's reverting back to his native tongue and not even really communicating in English. But, I mean, they can obviously see that there is something that's going on here and that things are not right. She's sort of trying to say to them, you know, this is a boy and he's in trouble. And they're sort of waiting to kind of maybe just sort of gather about some more information. Sort of out of the scene or out of the corner of their eye, I'm sure they notice that there's this other man there probably approaching them. And he sort of walks right up to the scene and asks what's going on. And so they are trying to explain to him. And a couple of people recognize that this is a man that lives in the building where the boys come out of. They can sort of verify that. But he's trying to tell the police that this is not a boy, that this is not a teenager, that this is actually a grown man, 19 years old, and it's his boyfriend. He's saying, you know, he's drunk. I just left him passed out in our apartment where we live. I went out to get more beer, holds up a six-pack to prove, you know, that this story is legit. And there sort of seems to be conflicting stories happening. There's what the woman's telling them or trying to tell them, what the man who is telling them, and he's really trying to convince them and is very convincing, I think, to say, you know, yes, this is my boyfriend. He's not a kid. I can prove it to you. I have his identification upstairs in my apartment if you'll just follow me. So the police bring the boy back up to what turns out to be Jeffrey Dahmer's apartment, and they're going through the apartment, and they're just sort of arm on each side of this boy, lugging him up to the apartment as well because he's still very stumbly. He's seemingly intoxicated, and they get to the door of 213 of the Oxford Apartments, and they go in. Now, the police sort of just sort of stand on the other side of the threshold, and the guy, the man of the apartment, goes, and he's looking for identification, flipping through things, and the police are just sort of trying to get their story straight, so they have to, because they know they're going to have to fill out some kind of paperwork and a report, but they basically want to sort of wrap this up as quickly as they can. The man sounds really legit. You know, he doesn't have identification, but he's showing them some photographs of the man, of the what he's saying is a man. It's actually a teenage boy, you know, without a shirt on, looking happy. He's got a drink in his hand. He's smiling for the camera. So they're thumbing through these pictures that look, okay, like maybe this guy's story is on the level. And essentially, long story short, they end up leaving the boy there and believing Dahmer's story. And they go, and Dahmer kills him within half an hour of their leaving. So there is the initial police call, which is, you know, there's a young guy out on the street naked. He looks like he's in trouble. Then later there is another call, and it turns out to be the aunt of one of the two girls, or no, it's actually the mother, sorry, of one of the two girls that was also helping this lady. And she's very concerned because she says, you know, I'm sure that this kid goes to my, you know, my niece's school, and they know him from the street, and he's not a man, he is a boy. And the police are just basically brushing her off. You know, we've done all we can, ma'am. Can't get involved in these little domestic squabbly thing type things. You know, it's not up to us to judge anybody's lifestyle. And she's not really saying any of that at all. She's basically saying, you know, are you sure? Are you absolutely positive that this is not a boy? And they assure her and basically wave her off, and that's the end of that. So, you know, here in hindsight, of course, is the opportunity where he could have really been stopped. That happened in May. He wasn't caught until July, and four men died in that period of time.
Now let's get to July 22nd, and a gentleman named Tracy Edwards, and you talk about that Tracy Edwards is at a mall and with some friends, a good-looking guy, a black guy, and Dahmer has his, as many people will know, maybe some people will know anyway, that Dahmer has a certain preferences, and we'll talk about that later in interrogation with Pat Kennedy, but tell us about Tracy Edwards and how, because this scene demonstrates how his ruse or his ploy, we'll say, to get people to come back to his apartment. So tell us how Jeffrey Dahmer and Tracy Edwards meet.
They meet in a mall. It's in Milwaukee, not too far from where Dahmer lived. And this was actually a place where Dahmer would go, and as he would tell Pat Kennedy, you know, initially he was going there mostly to people watch and just kind of, you know, he was a guy that didn't have really any friends at all, no one that he would hang around with regularly. So if he felt like he wanted to be social and he needed to sort of be out and about with people, I guess the mall was a good place for him to go. And so he would sort of go there also for cruising and sort of seeing and meeting guys that he would find attractive. And as you say, he did have seemed to have a type. And it talks about it quite extensively and several times in the interview with Kennedy. And that is that he really, really loves muscular, slight men that are tall and just sort of have really lean and good-looking muscles. If you had ever seen pictures of his apartment, apparently he had quite a bit of artwork that kind of featured muscles, mostly African-American men. And that was definitely what he would look for when he would go out to the clubs, to the gay clubs, and pick up a lot of men. When he would go to the mall, that's the kind of body type that he was looking for. He would, his ruse or his way of sort of seducing would be saying things like, you know, you've really got a nice looking body. I mean, I think what it would be is mostly like an exchange of glances, maybe first a smile, kind of a little joke or whatever have you, just to kind of introduce themselves. But eventually, within a couple of minutes or more, he would get to that point where he would feel comfortable enough to say to them, how would you like to come back to my apartment? I'd love to take some photographs of you. You know, we could have some drinks, maybe watch a movie. You know, I'll pay you $50 or $150, depending on what he had in terms of money that he could do this with. And so offer anywhere between $50 and $150. If the guy was really, really good looking and someone that he was very attracted to, then it would, of course, be more money. So money was always a good incentive. Sometimes it would really, you know, be the thing, I'm sure, that would be the main enticement, but also possibly just the opportunity to have a couple of free drinks with a guy. And, you know, if there was any kind of sexual seduction, that would be a little bonus, perhaps. But that was sort of his come on. That was sort of his way of getting these guys interested and coming back to his apartment.
Now, they pick up some beer. Jeff buys a six-pack, and they head over to the apartment. And nothing seems untoward as they head towards the apartment. Well, when you get to the apartment, just like the police, but the police are used to all kinds of uncommon things, so they're... What does Tracy Edwards notice immediately as he gets into that apartment building itself or near Jeffrey's apartment? And then tell us the rapid transition from things that were not untowards on the way there. Everything seems much different quickly. Tell us about that.
Tracy has been, has said in interviews and I guess in the court testimony when he testified at the Dahmer court case, that, you know, he sort of picked up pretty quickly as they were walking and getting to Jeff's apartment that, you know, this is a guy who's probably really shy, doesn't probably have a lot of friends, you know, maybe doesn't have an easy time making connections. He found him attractive, like he said, you know, he's a nice looking, decently dressed, blonde guy, blue eyes, you know, he's not an unappealing looking man. So, you know, there was sort of interest, I guess, on both sides. But I think that in his mind, whatever was going to happen was going to be, you know, some semi-harmless fun. But as soon as they get into the apartment and as soon as they get through the door of 213, he's just overwhelmed by this horrendous spell. And you can imagine, I mean, it's like end of July, very hot, very humid. This is like a little apartment, one-bedroom apartment with a window air conditioner. So, you know, it's already going to probably be uncomfortable and unpleasant. And he just walks in and just is overwhelmed and just almost knocked out by the smell. And so he, of course, asks about it immediately. And Dahmer had in the past given the excuse of, oh, well, my fish died. My fish in my aquarium died. Or I have a little freezer and some meat spoiled in there. And this is the excuse that he would give to neighbors and to the caretakers who would come and, you know, ask him about it and question him about it. He gave some excuse to Edwards and basically said, yeah, I know I've really complained about the smell to my manager, but he's not doing anything about it. So kind of just brushes it away and brushes it off. So they get into the apartment and Jeffrey's busy locking the door. And much later in his conversations with Kennedy, he would say, you know, as soon as I had that door locked, these guys were mine to control. Whether he would kill them or not, you know, it would be up for later decision. But as soon as they were locked in his apartment, he felt that, you know, it was they were his. So Edward said, you know, he almost noticed immediately that there was a change in Jeff, that he had gone from this sort of happy, you know, quiet, kind of reserved, polite guy to sort of there was a darkness about him. And he really couldn't put his finger on it, but he just really felt like, you know, he needed to lighten the mood a little bit. So Jeff poured him a drink and just handed him this drink and had a beer for himself. And he said the drink tasted awful, and he really just sort of sipped a little bit at it to be polite, but didn't really drink too much of it. And he said that Jeff was kind of quiet. He put in this movie. They were sitting or watching the movie. They were, you know, kind of – he was trying to engage Jeff in some conversation, asking him about where he worked and, you know, what kind of things he'd like to do for fun. And there really wasn't much of conversation coming from Jeff's side of the couch. But I guess he said, you know, I want to take some pictures and let's get you to take your shirt off. So Tracy complied. He felt like he had to. And then Jeff wanted to move things into the bedroom. So he did. And next thing you know, there's a knife in Jeff's hands. And so Tracy's, you know, probably really wondering, how did this get to this point this quickly? But yeah, over the course of several hours, there was sort of this back and forth of being in the bedroom, being in the front room where the air conditioning was and where the movie was playing, for him trying to calm Jeff down, but to sort of give the impression that he wasn't going to leave, you know, that I will be here and everything's cool, you know, you don't have to worry about having the knife, you know, you can even put it away if you want. And he said that Jeff was just kind of like rocking back and forth, and he was kind of like mumbling and chanting a little bit, and he just sort of kept rocking back and forth. And, of course, Jeff is drinking this entire time, so he's just getting more and more inebriated, maybe not even noticing really that Tracy has not taken this drink that has been laced with drugs. So this was really kind of a reversal of all of the other engagements that he had with most of the men that he killed. He would drink, but he would sort of stay in control, whereas his victims would be very healthy, athletic, usually men that would come to his apartment and then be basically drugged through drink and tablets that he would put in them. So he, it was kind of the opposite going on here. So Tracy, after several hours, says to himself, I have to get out of here or I'm not going to survive this. And so he punches Jeff and just manages to get out of the bedroom, get out of the apartment, get all the door locks undone, and just bolts, gets out of there. And he still has a handcuff that Jeff has put on earlier in the evening attached to his arm, but he does manage to escape. And I think in his testimony and in stories that he's told afterwards, articles, he has said that he just like felt that Dahmer was right behind him that entire time. And you could only imagine, you know, like he must be starting to think the smell of that apartment, who knows really what he all saw, you know, because it's a weird little apartment with all these bodies we eventually find out. But I mean, just Jeff was a very strange guy, and just suddenly in the apartment, he changed. And he definitely felt like his life was in danger, and it very much was.
What we forgot to mention, and it's just because movies have a little bit of a role in this, it's just interesting. Some of the biggest movies in the world, horror movies anyway, just happen to be fiction and reality at the same time intersect, is that Jeffrey Dahmer's, one of his favorite movies was Exorcist III. So that's the movie he put on. He was rocking back and forth. And he also said to Edwards, he said, I'm going to cut your heart out and eat it.
That's right. He does say that to him. Yeah. So, Tracy very, very smartly, I think, when I look back on this whole story and this whole scenario, this whole scene as it's unfolding, he did the absolute right thing. You know, he heard it, but he pretended that he didn't hear it. And he just sort of said what he could to calm Dahmer down. He didn't try and, like, jump out of the van and wrestle with a knife. You know, he sort of just thought it out and just said, you know, the more I appease this guy, the better. You know, I think he just sort of felt like the more I can sort of just calm him down, then there'll be more of an opportunity for me to, you know, punch him, knock him over, and at least have a chance to possibly escape.
Now, you talk about Edwards flagging down the first police cruiser that comes into vision. So obviously he, you know, we know the outcome, but tell us what the police do this time when they go back to Jeffrey Dahmer's apartment, as opposed to when he was a Laotian voice.
That's right. Edwards did not want to go back there. He was so frightened, and he was, you know, rightfully so, just, you know, terrified. I can't imagine that he's going to be brought back to this scene. Of course, it's a different story. You know, he's able to tell the police, you know, if they had asked him what was going on. He just really wanted to get the cuffs off his hand. That was his biggest concern. He's like, I don't even want to press charges. I just want, you know, to get these things off my arm. So recognizing that they weren't Milwaukee Police Department issue, they said, well, we need to get whoever has the key to them to get them off. So they take him back to Dahmer's apartment after much persuading, and they're standing there. Now, Jeff has been knocked out, and he's still very, very drunk from all the beer that he's been drinking. It's probably very late. It is after midnight. And there's these cops standing there with the guy, you know, that he's just punched him and escaped. So they say this fellow has handcuffs on his arm. He wants them off. Where's the key? So they come in, and they, of course, can smell, you know, the same thing that Edwards had smelled hours earlier and that everyone in the apartment was complaining about. And, you know, Jeff is sort of fumbling around, and, you know, in the back of his mind, he's thinking, I don't have the key. Like, I don't know where the key is, because he's never needed the key. Anytime he's handcuffed somebody, they've been a victim that he can cut their arm off to take the handcuffs off. So he's never needed the key. So I'm sure he's thinking to himself, how am I going to get out of this? But the more time that the cops are there, the more things are just really feeling weird, odd. That smell is getting to them, starting to look around a little bit. They see there's a stack of some Polaroid pictures of men in various stages of undress. Then they're starting to see pictures of bodies and body parts and viscera. And so one of them just yells, grab him. So they get him down onto the ground. He's wrestling around, and he's really, you know, trying to resist, but they get him down. And, of course, they call it in. And that's basically how the police stopped Jeffrey Dahmer.
Now, before, it's very fascinating because this is something I did not know. And this is where we take this brilliant manuscript and fuse it with the brilliant work you do, too, to bring this story to life and fuse it with this incredible interrogation. But the point where Pat Kennedy's still not involved, these officers, like you say, are looking around. They see the Polaroids. They know the things up. They arrest Jeffrey. Tell us what's in the one bedroom, and then tell us what those police find. And then, as you talk about in the book, what's the call that Pat Kennedy gets?
They, as they're looking at these photographs, they've got Dahmer contained. You know, he's down on the ground, and he's handcuffed. And then the police start to go through this apartment a little bit. They, for whatever reason, and I'm sure the cop to this day doesn't know why he decided to do this, but he opens the fridge door, and there is a severed head sitting in the fridge. And it takes him a couple of seconds to realize that this is real. And that's when they realize this is a serious, serious case, and that, you know, like, this isn't just a run-of-the-mill kind of a thing that's going on. This is something that they've never, ever dealt with before. They start to, I don't know at that point with just these two officers there, you know, how much they really started to look around, because you start to hear of the things that they're finding, but that's really when more officers arrive and forensic people are showing up, and Dahmer's actually already in custody at that point, and he's in the interrogation room with Kennedy. But they find these big drums in his bedroom that have torsos and limbs. They find in the freezer there are pieces of flesh that are wrapped up, that he is cut up and filleted almost. They find more heads. They find skulls. They're just finding, like, you know, I mean, it's a horror movie, really. I mean, this is the difference between a serial killer who leaves body parts around for the police to find, and the whole community and neighborhood and city is aware that there's a serial killer on the loose. This is actually finding the killer and finding all of the bodies and then getting the whole story, you know. So it's very – that's in a way makes it very unique. But Patrick actually was working the third shift, so he's showing up for work and just kind of getting settled in with a cup of coffee, and his partner shows up, and then they get a call from their captain saying, you know, we just got a call. You guys are up next. It sounds like it's a homicide, something about a head in the fridge. Probably nothing. It's probably a prank, but you have to go check it out. And so that's the call they get, and they're, you know, kind of, you know, puzzled about it, figuring it's probably just a big joke.
even making jokes about the whole thing. So they get out into this hot, hot night in their car, you know, getting to the scene. They get to the apartment, and immediately they're overwhelmed by the smell. And I think it's something that all cops say, you know, once you've smelled it once, you know it, and that's the smell of decomp.
Yeah.
And so they go up to the apartment, and, you know, Pat very nicely explains sort of everything that unfolds as he sees it when he first walks through that door.
Yeah, this is so. So now in the interrogation room for our audience, I mean, this is a savvy audience, but how is it that Jeffrey Dahmer, like many other serial killers and killers, why he wouldn't ask for a lawyer? What is the circumstances in which Jeffrey would be interested, and this is part of it, that Jeffrey would be not so interested in calling a lawyer? How does it come to be that that is not something that Jeffrey Dahmer immediately inquires about and desires?
Well, I think initially Dahmer in that room, probably for the first little bit of time, really believed that he could probably talk his way out of this. If you know the story, you know that he sort of had a history and had lots of practice and lots of success at actually fooling authorities with the story of the police and the Laotian boy on the street, you know, and times before that as well, where he managed to sort of talk his way out of a bad situation. So, you know, initially that might have been instinct number one. I think instinct number two for him was to shut down and actually say nothing at all, not ask for anything, not say anything, and basically just sort of clam up. And, you know, he was always a very quiet person, so this would not be an unusual tack for him to take. I think what actually got him to open up, and you sort of do think, why wouldn't he ask for a lawyer? Wouldn't that be the first thing out of his mouth? But his first reaction, I think, was to please Kennedy. This guy comes in, he's asking him if he wants coffee, do you want some cigarettes, sort of is buddying up to him, and it's really nothing at all what Jeff was expecting. So I think he very quickly just really bonded and connected with him and wanted to please him. And so he just sort of started to tell his story. And Kennedy very wisely played it perfectly by sort of letting him talk, you know, asking some questions, nothing too hard, but really just kind of saying to him, you know, there's nothing you can say that you've done that's going to upset me. I'm not here to judge you. I'm just here to get your story.
And you really take the audience, the reader, into this too, is because he says, please, Pat, just take your gun out and shoot me. Just end it.
Yeah, yeah. And Kennedy is horrified to realize that he still had his gun holstered to his hip, and he was pretty, I think, embarrassed in a way. And but, you know, you got to imagine the shock he was in from everything that had just gone on in the previous hour, because he had been in that apartment. You know, he had seen, that was when he met Jeff for the first time. He's like down on the floor in handcuffs. And right there, you know, Kennedy is assuring him that he's going to be okay, because Jeff thinks, are you going to beat me up too? And, you know, that was the first thing that Kennedy said is, no, I'm not going to beat you up. You know, I just want to talk to you.
This is it's incredible. And you also do, he asked the question, do you know what hydrochloric acid would do if you put it into your veins? And so he's talking to Pat Kenny about that, and then he's crying like a little scared little boy, Pat said. And a little puddle of tears underneath his chair. And Pat said, I genuinely felt sorry for him. So he said this was a good time to take a break.
Yeah, you know, Kennedy, you know, found himself, you know, I think almost in spite of himself, liking Jeff, because he sort of said, you know, he's actually not a bad guy. I mean, he's done terrible, horrible, monstrous things, but he goes, you can sit and have coffee with him. He did. He sat and had coffee and cigarettes with him. They had lunch together several times. They would talk about things in the paper when they were not doing the interrogation part of the day. You know, he just sort of came to kind of like the guy. And I know it really bothered him sort of on some levels, and it took him a really long time to, I mean, I think if you use the word friend, I think he would cringe a little, and he didn't want to think of it as a relationship necessarily, but I think in the end he really did say it was a relationship, because we did talk, and you know, like, I like the guy, you know. There's a lot of other guys, bad guys that I've met that I don't like, that I hate, but this guy, you know, he was okay, because he was polite and he was willing to talk, and he was willing to help them. He was willing to talk to them about who his victims were, because back in 1991, if you think about it, you know, they didn't necessarily have all of the tools available to them forensically to identify all of these victims. And in some cases, there was nothing left of the victim, or very little left of the victim. And so Jeff was really instrumental in actually bringing, you know, some relief possibly to those family members who are wondering whatever happened to our uncle, our brother, our son, our dad, you know.
That's what I wanted to talk about, because this is, I think, the pivotal point in the interrogation, is that Pat utilizes all of his own history, his own experiences, good and bad, and incorporates that, as you know, describe in the book, that he has a background as an AA member, a former drinker, and he has been raised Roman Catholic. So tell us how he uses those two things to convince Jeffrey to help, and what that help is. What help does he ask for specifically?
Yeah, that's probably one of the things that, you know about, when you know Kennedy, you know about him, is the fact that he was an alcoholic, and that he sought treatment. He had been clean for quite a long time before the whole Dahmer case came up. But, you know, it's sort of still a struggle that he had. And so, you know, maintaining a sober life when you have a history of alcoholism, not just your own, but in your family, plus, you know, very stressful job, family, money worries, the whole bit. So he recognized in his talking with Jeff pretty early on that Jeff had a serious drinking problem, and was able to say, you know, to himself, I can connect with him on this. And that was what they did talk about. I don't think he actually came out and said, you know, Jeff, if you hadn't been drinking, this wouldn't have happened necessarily. But he did say, you know, in his experience, alcohol has sometimes played a big part in a case, especially a case of homicide, and that, you know, it's something that he was able to use to get Jeff to open up. And the whole religious and religion in their lives, Kennedy was Roman Catholic, Jeff was raised Lutheran, but they had a lot of conversations about God and the existence of God, and you know, the part that religion played in their life. And Jeff really felt that, you know, when he abandoned religion and stopped going to church and stopped talking about the Bible and Jesus to his grandmother, that that's when things kind of started to slide for him. You know, he didn't blame that lack of religion on anyone but himself, but, you know, he said that when he stopped focusing on, you know, living the good life, living a better life, that's when things sort of spiraled out of control. So they did talk about that quite a bit as well. And Pat, very early on in his life, had actually wanted to be a Catholic priest, and he had actually started to attend pre-seminary classes, and that was sort of the direction that his life was leading, that he was actually going to become a Catholic priest. So the idea of the confessional model, I think, was something that appealed to him, and that, you know, he actually just would naturally incorporate into any conversation that he would have with a suspect, Dahmer or otherwise. So I think that, you know, he just sort of used his natural innate abilities and his own experience to kind of connect with this suspect. And it worked very quickly. You know, it's within that first night that Jeff was just basically telling him about everything that he had done.
Now, with also with the addition of cigarettes and hot coffee, he does not ask for a lawyer, and he keeps continuing the conversation. And you talked about the six the numerous hours with Jeffrey Dahmer. So tell us about what exactly they go through, and the identification of the victims, and what exactly Jeffrey, how he talks about, because he is a unique serial killer in that he doesn't try to justify, blame other people, blame the victims. So he's unique in that respect. So what exactly does Jeffrey Dahmer talk about specifically, and how does he talk to Pat Kennedy about his crimes and his victims and what he has done and his fantasies?
Well, this is where, you know, Kennedy, and then through Kennedy and this manuscript, people really learn, I think, more than we've ever really known about what focus Dahmer had as far as choosing his victims and what he was looking for. And you're absolutely right when you say, you know, this wasn't, you know, where he was, the kind of things in terms of his victims. He wasn't blaming them. He wasn't saying, well, that person deserves to die, so I'm going to kill them. In his case, he claimed that he loved all of his victims, that he wanted his victims to be with him, and that he didn't want them to leave. He didn't want them to abandon him. So that was why he would choose to kill them, because then they would be with him, you know, for the rest of their life, so that he would have them till the end. And so when he's talking to Kennedy about these victims, and that's exactly what Pat had said to him. You know, he said the only thing you could maybe even do to kind of have any kind of show of remorse and to show that you are sorry for what you did, you know, and for to have people believe that, is to help us to identify these people, because then you're at least giving those families, you know, a reasonable story to what happened to them. Because right now these are all men that have just disappeared. And so we can give them some, I hate to use the word closure, but we can give them some, you know, understanding of what happened to them. And so, you know, Dahmer readily agrees to do this. And I mean, part of it is the fact that he can sit there and talk to them. And, you know, Kennedy, time after time, you know, startles him by not being shocked and surprised. Like, he just continues to listen and ask questions, but not say, Jeff, what a horrible thing that you did, or why would you do that? Or, you know, I mean, when he did ask that, it was more just out of a curiosity. It wasn't to place blame or to judge him at all. And yeah, I mean, Jeff just basically kind of goes through, you know, every time he would go out, he would pick somebody up, he would bring them home. He didn't know the names of the victims, so they were doing this all through photography, through pictures that the families had brought in of their missing loved one, of the apartments, the photos that they found in his apartment, and in some cases, police photos that they had of people who had been previously arrested. So this is how they were basically identifying these victims. He was basically telling them the story of the pickup, what he would do, whether they were drinking and whether he drugged them, you know, sort of how it all unfolded, why he would kill them, and what he was doing specifically with each of the bodies, because there was a progression. Like, initially he was just sort of dispatching these people, these men. Then he was sort of trying to keep them alive a little bit, because he just felt it was such a waste to kill them. So he was drilling holes in their head to try and make kind of zombie boyfriends, if you will. And so, you know, as they're discovering things, as the medical examiner is telling them things, they're asking Jeff about it, and then he's explaining as they go.
Now, you talk about this conversation and this rapport that they have, Patrick has with Jeffrey Dahmer, and little by little, there is the ability, the evidence that Jeffrey provides, the background information that he did keep some evidence of their identification, didn't he? Some of the victims, wasn't there some?
Yeah, I think in most cases he burned stuff or threw it away or just tossed it in the toilet and flushed it, but I think that he did have some identification. There was one man that he really, really was attracted to, and that person's identification, actually, I think they did find it in the drawer of his bedroom. But really, like, if you think about it in terms of trophies, like, you know, and I don't really think that would be the right word necessarily, but I mean, he kept the men. Like, he tried to keep their skulls, he tried to keep some of their body parts, bones. I mean, they found a lot of bones in his apartment, so that was actually what he needed in order to remind himself of what he had done. And he was using these you know, to masturbate, the photographs that he had taken, not only of the men alive but of the men dead. And so, you know, this was all part of his, basically his sexual addiction, which was necrophilia. I mean, that was his paraphilia, which was that he liked, well, he liked incapacitated men. That's what he really wanted to sleep with, was men that who would not ask anything of him, but that he could do whatever he wanted to them. But it almost always ended with most of these pickups with, you know, the man dead.
When you talk about necrophilia, again, it's one of those very rare areas that only some of these people, again, a paraphilia. But to add to that, and this is part of Dahmer's uniqueness too, in the experimentation, and also what about the conversation Pat had with cannibalism? When he asked why was there cannibalism?
Well, in Jeff's mind, that he had this kind of romantic notion that this was a way that he could keep these lovers with him forever, and that they would always be a part of him, that he could ingest them, and that they would always be there. So for him, that was sort of what he was doing. And again, it was more sort of towards the end, I think, of his killing spree. But he certainly, I mean, he had flesh and body parts in his freezer. And I mean, when the officers were unpacking these things, they're saying it looks like cuts of meat, and it's very much almost prepared that way too. According to Patrick and the investigation that they did, you know, that was pretty much all he was consuming in the last month before they caught him. They found condiments, and they found like vegetables and sort of side dishes that you would have perhaps. But I mean, the only meat he was really eating was human flesh. And, you know, I think he didn't talk about this initially. Dahmer claims that he wasn't really sure whether it would matter in terms of, you know, like, I'm telling you about all the men I killed. Does it matter, you know, whether I cannibalized them or not? And then he also said, I didn't want you to think less of me. You know, he was worried about that might be too taboo, that they would eventually just say, okay, enough's enough, we can't take any more of this. But once again, Kennedy was able to find within himself, and the other detective that helped him, of course, with all this, to really just kind of go ahead and move past it. And, of course, they did ask him. And, again, it was really about this, I wanted to keep them with me.
Now, you don't talk about too much in the book, but there is Jeffrey Dahmer has to move, and so that creates a lot of anxiety in his life. And so, as you say, his modus operandi, everything that he did, he used to be, and he does say to Pat, I think, yeah, I used to be really careful. So he seemed to be very, very disorganized and more so chaotic and careless. And then we get the difference between the calm, cool, and collect with the Laotian boy and Jeffrey Dahmer's luck just runs out, basically. So
he was definitely out of control those last, you know, 6 weeks or so in terms of the amount of men he was killing, the fact that he was drinking so much more and getting like so drunk and passing out that bodies were starting to pile up. And even he admitted that he wasn't able to dispose of them as quickly as he was killing them. So there was that. Again, there was the smell. It was summertime. So he was dealing with that. Things weren't really going very well with him at work. And in fact, he knew that he was going to be let go because he'd been so much work. He would sort of try and do all that he was doing with these men from the pickup to the disposal all over the course of the weekend. But then sometimes that wasn't enough. And so he was actually killing maybe two men a week. And so it was really, things were just really sort of spiraling out of control. And he knew it. I mean, he just knew that he was getting sloppy. He was getting lazy about things. But he didn't really do anything to, you know, turn it around.
Now, with at the same time, and you point out in the book, it's very interesting, and I remember this at that time, too, reading Silence of the Lambs and then realizing not that long after the movie comes out and it sweeps the Academy Awards, and everybody knows the story of the two horrible villains in that movie, one a cannibal and one a person that's making a new suit from a human suit. Anyway, you could talk about what you said about Silence of the Lambs and then the uncanny art imitates life sort of coincidence in terms of timing. And then from there, tell us what the media's response was to this story in little old Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the irony, really, of Silence of the Lambs and this sort of whole movie that really kind of swept the Academy Awards. Everyone was talking about it. You know, it was such amazing performances, Jodie Foster, Anthony Hopkins, like, just, you know, it was just a really well-received movie, and it really just kind of opened up this new area, I think, of that horror genre, just sort of so different at that time, and became like a classic. People love that movie now, even now, and but yeah, the irony of the psychiatrist, the serial killer, and then what is going on with the skinning of victims. So as soon as the whole Jeffrey Dahmer story came out, People magazine, I think the week after, had a true Silence of the Lambs horror story in this little apartment in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And it was really like, how could he have gotten away with this for so long? That was really the main focus of the story. Who was this guy and how did he manage to kill all these people without, you know, really anyone having any kind of knowledge that there was a serial killer in their midst? So yeah, there was definitely sort of this whole, as you say, art imitating true life going on at that time in 91. And Wisconsin, I mean, the other interesting thing about that is that the whole Ed Gein story, which also took place, I think it was in Plainfield, Wisconsin, many, many decades earlier, but that movie was actually also the inspiration for, one of the inspirations for Silence of the Lambs. So it does kind of go full circle a little bit. And, you know, yes, a state known for dairy production, beer production, and happy days. You know, now it's still forever now marred by the Dahmer story.
Yeah. So tell us about how long this interrogation was. What was the net result in terms of, did they identify all of the victims? And how complete and truthful and plausible was this full confession that Kennedy and his associate, another detective, elicited from Jeffrey Dahmer? So what was it all contained in there? Was everything that they ever needed for a trial, for a conviction, was it in there?
I think that Kennedy, the detectives, and the prosecutor all felt that Dahmer was honest with them, that once caught, he really just sort of felt, what would be the point of holding anything back? I will admit to 17 killings, but not 18. Like, it was just, I mean, he basically said, I'm going to tell you everything. There's no reason to not tell you everything now. Interesting about, you know, another little connection with the Silence of the Lambs and how big of a role the FBI played in that, because, of course, Foster's character is, you know, trained to be an FBI agent, and it's sort of all over the movie. Well, in Milwaukee, Dennis Murphy and Patrick Kennedy kept getting visited by these two agents from the FBI who were absolutely convinced that Dahmer is snowing you, he's laughing at you, there's no way he's telling you the whole story. And in fact, you know, you guys might even be suffering a little bit because you're getting too close to. And they kind of laughed it off and they said, you know, you can leave your information. The FBI agents really wanted to interview Jeffrey Dahmer, but they said, you know, we have him first and then it's up to his lawyer to decide if he's going to talk to anyone else in authority. And so the FBI kind of walked away empty-handed, but Kennedy and Murphy believe that Dahmer told them everything because they were able to identify, certainly like through the photographs and Dahmer's sort of an uncanny recollection of dates and when missing reports were made and when people were last seen. And so they were able to confirm everything. Like they said, you know, he wasn't always necessarily forthcoming with information, but if they asked him a question, they always felt that he was telling them the truth. And, I mean, several times along the way, they tried to fool him. They tried to trick him. They really tried to get him to somehow admit to something that he hadn't done so that they could turn around and say, ha-ha, Jeff, we caught you in a lie. But, you know, every time they did, he came clean, basically. And so I think that Patrick, you know, never doubted that they got the entire story because, again, you know, he would admit to all of this and admit to all the things that he did. And I think that, I mean, we get a lot in this book, but I mean, there's probably things that Kennedy just felt he could not even express in writing that he learned about Dahmer. And he said, if he's willing to admit to all of this, then I don't have any reason to believe he's holding back.
No, can't even imagine what else anyone could even imagine doing.
Doing, exactly.
Now, with this relationship that's a little lopsided, obviously, because Jeffrey really thinks he's a friend because he's never been able to talk without any kind of judgment before. Obviously, he's kept this super dark secret a secret forever. This is something, who are you going to share this with? So he sees these, Pat Kennedy and Murphy, as at least confidants. And so the relationship ends. Pat Kennedy is able to compartmentalize. He can feel empathy, but it's a job, and he's a professional. So just tell us about that, because it's interesting what you write, how Pat talks about ending this relationship.
Well, I think, because of the intensity of it all, you know, everything that he's being told by Jeff, everything that Jeff's admitting to, the media scrutiny, you know, sort of the pressure that he was feeling as a pretty young detective. He was only 37 at the time, had been on the Homicide Bureau for a couple of years, but I mean, still considered to be a little on the green side to have caught such a heavy case. So there's all this pressure, and then there's things going on at home in terms of his marriage and, you know, living with kids. They were all sort of preteen and teenage. This is actually a remarriage, so, you know, there's sort of that, a little bit of stress there too. So there's all this going on. His wife is worried, you know, are you going to be driven to go to the bottle because of all of this? She's worried that he's not going to be seeking professional help, like through therapy. You know, he's confident that he's got it under wraps, under control. And there is no issue with that at all anyway. So, you know, that's not really a reality pressure necessarily, but he's got all of this sort of on his head as this case is going on. So there has to be a certain amount of relief when it is going to finally come to an end and he doesn't have to deal with the Dahmer story anymore. He's going to go to prison forever, and that's that. So there is this meeting, you know, Dahmer has been, he's actually admitted to guilt. So it wasn't as though they had to prove that he was guilty. He pled guilty. What was up for debate was whether he was insane or not. And of course, his lawyers are saying he's insane, prosecutors saying he knew exactly what he was doing and he should be held responsible for that. He, of course, was found sane. And so there is this little meeting in the back of the judge's quarters where he's in a cell and Patrick goes in and they do have sort of a chance to say goodbye and a handshake. And, you know, the sort of whole thing kind of comes to an end. And, you know, everyone is cheering. The papers have got their story. The media is all, you know, abuzz because this is now sort of the final chapter of this very long story. The city feels as though it can now start to heal and repair itself a little bit and just put this kind of mess behind them. You know, families can move on. And, you know, I'm sure in many ways Kennedy just further felt that that was the end of it. I mean, he knew it was a case-making, career-making, you know, opportunity, but, you know, you can't live at that pitch for so many weeks, and it was certainly many, many weeks. I mean, there was the initial 6 weeks of the interrogation, the daily sitting in the room with Jeff and getting the story, but then there was sort of this downtime while everyone's preparing for the case, and he goes back to the night shift, no longer on day shift. And then it's the trial, you know, and it's basically the decision. So then he's back on day shift and he's running witnesses around and basically just being available should anyone need him. So it was, again, this very big sort of moment in terms of what was going to be the decision and then sort of the aftermath of that. But as I said earlier, I mean, he did become sort of the go-to guy at Milwaukee. I mean, everyone wanted to talk to him. Kennedy is a great storyteller, so he's a very good interview. And, you know, he actually was there. He sat face-to-face. He was the detective that Dahmer insisted on talking to.
Right. Now, this is a subject of a documentary, and so then he has written this manuscript. And the attention from this case has certainly not dissipated. His face is on, when people talk about serial killers, his face is among those top 10, you know, the legends of serial killers. And so he's fascinated people for years and years. So as you say, Pat Kennedy was the guy that people would talk to and do interviews. But at some point, before, say, the documentary, it seemed that there was less interest, and then it seemed to go in waves in terms of interest in Jeffrey Dahmer, and hence that the documentary, again, years after the crime, obviously.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, there is a certain amount of stuff about Dahmer, but not a lot of stuff about Dahmer,
That's partly right.
Because there wasn't really the hunt for a serial killer. You know, they basically caught this guy and then realized that they had a serial killer. So, you know, it was sort of, there wasn't sort of the whodunit part of the story. They already knew whodunit. It was just a matter of identifying the victims and finding out why, like finding out what turned this pretty ordinary, average, almost boring guy who worked in a chocolate factory into this, you know, sort of sexual predator killer. So there was that. And I guess the amount of time that goes by, too. Like, this is a 25-year-old case now. This summer is the 20th anniversary of his arrest. So, you know, right. There's lots more new crimes that have occurred in that period of time. So, you know, it's like anything. I think that sort of comes in waves, I think, as people learn about him and hear about him. I mean, there's like 20-year-olds now who don't know who Jeffrey Dahmer is, and they're interested in reading this book because they want to sort of hear it from the historical point of view. They want to sort of place it back in 91 and just sort of see how police sort of did their job and how this all kind of came together in that time frame.
Now, how recognized was...
Oh,
go ahead.
I was also going to say, just to add to that, too, I think also because Dahmer confessed, you know, like they didn't have to sort of, you know, turn the screws on him. They didn't have to do a bunch of investigation because they didn't have a willing criminal. I mean, he was willing to talk to them. So I think there is, I mean, it's not that it didn't make the story more interesting. I mean, there's lots of interesting facts that come out of it, but it's sort of just a very unusual way that he came to be known, you know? And yeah, you know, you hear Jeffrey Dahmer, most people know who you're talking about because, as you say, he's in the legions of serial killers. He's really high up there.
When you talk about the why of this, what did Pat must have wondered, as you wonder, and we all wonder, the why. How did it come to be that this, as everybody seems to know, he didn't come from the kind of backgrounds that you would think. And, of course, Jeffrey Dahmer never blamed his family, and there's been family support. So it doesn't seem to be, and Jeffrey doesn't claim that there is as well. So did Pat ask that question? Did he get any inkling of the why?
like, why did he have the attraction, or why did
he went from this, again, no sinister background that seems to be at least what killers claim to have had happen to them, and there are certainly killers that have had horrendous backgrounds, but Jeffrey's, again, like you talk in this book, and people know some other interviews as well, that he was very, very candid. Didn't say his family had anything to do with this. It wasn't his upbringing. So, again, didn't seem to be any trigger, we'll say.
Mm-hmm.
Did Pat, in this interrogation, pose that question to Jeffrey? How did you come to, or did he have that, pose that question to himself? Is there an answer to the why?
Mm-hmm. I think that that question was asked several times. Like, I think that Kennedy asked it. I'm sure his family asked him. You know, anyone who talked to him, you know, when the FBI talked to him and the profilers talked to him, the forensic psychiatrists talked to him. I'm sure that all of the times that he talked about what he did, the why he did it would invariably come up. And, you know, I don't know if any of the answers that he gave really satisfied necessarily, because as you say, you know, he didn't have an abusive background. He didn't have parents who didn't love him or give him enough attention. You know, he had a dad that worked pretty hard and wasn't around a lot. He had a mother who had some mental problems, suffered from depression and anxiety, was hospitalized a few times. I think it was not sort of a one thing that led him to become what he became. I think it was the fact that he did spend a lot of time alone. He apparently was a really lonely kid and didn't have a lot of friends, seemed to have a hard time with being around people and be around kids his own age. In school, he was always sort of the weird kid, the quiet, shy guy, you know, would occasionally play a prank and try and be funny, but most of the time, you know, people just kind of ignored him. He's kind of the invisible kid. And I think that, you know, there was sort of that. He was drinking at a pretty young age. Like by his late teens or mid-teens, he was drinking pretty much every day. So I think that the fact that he was drinking probably did affect him, and maybe it inhibited him a little bit in terms of, or disinhibited him a little bit in terms of taking chances later on when he was killing regularly. But in terms of, yeah, I mean, it was really his sexual desire. Like he was very, very sexual in terms of he would masturbate a lot, and he seemed to fantasize a lot. So this loneliness and the fantasy life, somewhere in there, it became very sexual and it became kind of dark and then violent. Not that he wanted to impose violence on anybody, but basically what he wanted to do was to find a man that he was attracted to, incapacitate that man, and then do whatever he wanted to them sexually. So, you know, these fantasies and this darkness sort of stayed with him, and he tried to curb it. He tried to, you know, kind of make it go away and just sort of try and ignore it. And it just sort of kept coming back. It kept overwhelming him, and to the point where, you know, he acted it out on it when he was 18 and says and seemed to be quite horrified by what he did. And in fact, it stayed with him, the guilt of that, for all of his life. And he managed to go 9-10 years between his first killing and the second time that he killed. And then around that time, he was kind of like, the second time, actually, he claims it was an accident because he was in a hotel room with a man. They were both drinking and having sex, but then he woke up in the morning and his arms were bruised and the guy was dead. He has no recollection of what he did, but he freely admitted, I must have killed the guy because, you know, I just don't remember it. I blacked out afterwards and I have no memory of it. But he took full responsibility for it. So then there became this path where he was sort of trying to stop himself, but he couldn't stop himself. And then, you know, finally he just sort of agreed to abandon any stop capacity that he might have had. And then he was on a regular cycle. He got into this habit of going out to the clubs, drinking, watching these good-looking men dance, trying to do a seduction, try and encourage them to come back to his apartment. And it just became his routine. That was his social life, essentially.
Right. Now, we know that Jeffrey Dahmer was convicted, and we will get to his fateful end in a minute. But after this case, not only does Kennedy known as the Dahmer detective, but also Kennedy steps into a role that's quite different, but yet very, very important and very, very satisfying and gratifying to him in his career as a police officer. So tell us what Patrick Kennedy does after that and what is his beliefs that the police need to do.
Well, he stayed on the police force for about 10 years after Dahmer, like after they arrested Dahmer. So I think it was around 2000, 2001 or so that he retired from the police force. And he wanted to really sort of take what they had learned from the Dahmer case and sort of try to make improvements, provide better training for officers, because he said, you know, we have all these mistakes that were made in terms of, you know, the police leaving a victim in Dahmer's hands and then that kid basically being killed, you know, within half an hour of their leaving, the police leaving. And so they wanted to train. And he said, you know, I know exactly how it happened. He knew those officers. And he said, you know, the training that they had kind of dictated that it kind of go down the way it went down. He wasn't excusing the neglect that I think he felt went into the case. And I think he thought that, you know, of course, hindsight is always 20/20, but if he'd been there, you know, he probably would have tried to ask some more questions, try to ascertain a little bit more information, and not just sort of simply left after just a few minutes of sort of getting some more answers out of Dahmer and trying to get some more answers out of this kid. Like he thinks he might have or possibly could have done a little bit more. But basically his overall observation of that whole situation was that, you know, they, police, were listening to the white guy that looked and sounded like they did, and that they couldn't understand this kid anyway, so they really kind of focused more on what Dahmer was telling them. Even though there was a woman there and a couple of teenage girls who were trying to say to the police, you know, no, like, listen to us, he is a kid, you know, we know him, he goes to our school, and they just were not really, you know, they he feels that they were not trained to kind of take in the whole thing and to actually know the community that they're policing. So these were things that he wanted to sort of try and take away from the Dahmer case and use to improve things with police in general. So after he retired, he actually went down to South America and spent some time there working with police and trying to get a program together, which is the Police Athletic League. And essentially it's a program in the States that is geared towards getting police more involved in the communities that they are policing and to working with kids and young people and to try and encourage, you know, healthy choices and healthy decisions in terms of choosing a legit life and a life of crime, and to sort of be there, not as the police necessarily, but to sort of be more of a part of the community. So in terms of what's going on in the States right now, it's actually quite interesting because these are all issues that we're dealing with or they had to deal with back 25 years ago. But, you know, he was really, really committed to police having a more positive presence in the community. So he really sort of tried to do a lot where there was projects where he would travel and talk about this Police Athletic League. The reason they called it the Athletic League is that initially it was very focused on sports. And so Pat Kennedy, being a former basketball player at 6'7", was very passionate about that. So he actually organized street games with kids in the community in the inner city of Milwaukee, and, you know, with Coach Kennedy as he's running up and down the streets, blowing his whistle and getting the kids involved. And, you know, he was very involved with another establishment through his church where he would go, and it was like an open door cafe and people could come in and have at least one hot free meal a day. And, you know, he just really loved being, you know, he, even though he retired from being a police officer, I think he was just a heart, in his heart, a cop. And so he was sort of that to the very end. But he did go on also to teach criminology at two universities in Wisconsin. And so, you know, he was really involved in criminal justice long after he retired from NYPD.
Now, you say he passed away in April 2013, and you talked about corresponding and connecting with Pat, his wife, his widow, to put this brilliant manuscript in, and get it published and add your own brilliant efforts as well. Tell us about who publishes this. Who publishes this, and how people might find out more information about this book? And do you do Facebook? You have a website? How might people contact you once they do check out this incredible book?
Well, people who want to get in touch with me to either talk about the book or ask questions about it or purchase a copy, if they want to do it directly from me and get a signed copy, should get in touch through poisonberrypress@gmail.com. The book is going to be available on Amazon, so it actually is up there right now, but it's not going to be available until the end of July. So, but people can place orders, I think, right now if they want to. And, yeah, it's going to be available in bookstores and basically any way that you get your hands on a book. E-copies will be available shortly, and also possibly an audiobook. So, yeah, there's going to be multiple ways and mediums that the book's going to be available. But if people contact me through that Gmail address, poisonberrypress@gmail.com, then I'd be happy to answer any questions that they might have. And if anyone, once they've read it, if they want to review it and send me a copy, that'd be awesome too.
Right on. Thank you very much for coming on and talking about this. Again, I told the audience this is an exclusive. This is the first time you've spoken about this book and the debut of this book, Dahmer Detective, The Investigation and Interrogation That Shocked the World. The definitive story about Jeffrey Dahmer and the definitive story about the brilliant detective, Pat Kennedy, who got every bit of the shocking story from Jeffrey Dahmer. Very, very incredible book. Thank you very much, Robin, for coming on and talking about it today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dan. I appreciate it.
Have a great evening. Good night.